Paul Matthews of IT Professionals New Zealand at CE is with us now. Good morning.
G'day, Catherine. How are you?
Good, thanks. Now, we've been talking a lot the last 24 hours about these massive health reforms. And yes, everyone says there's so much inconsistency between district health boards. They're all doing their different things. Look at all their different IT systems. And my question is, on IT as it is on everything else, why haven't we just dealt with that issue?
Yeah.
Why are we now thinking that a massive, massive restructuring with all the distractions and pressures that come with it is suddenly going to resolve that we're short of specialists, that we're short of GPs, or that our IT systems are out of date?
Yeah, that's right. And I think the, you know, the consistency between DHBs is the biggest issue from a tech side as well. And we've got a lot of different systems being used across a lot of different DHBs. You know, we do have 20 DHBs, but in actual fact, a lot of them have kind of operated in clusters from a tech perspective, and I think more broadly as well in some cases. So there aren't 20 different sets of tech systems, but there are certainly numerous, and it's a massive project to bring them together.
Yeah. Whatever happens, and whether you're whether you're doing it under the current system or another system, what stops it happening? Is it simply too hard to do something that we know always comes with delays and with, you know, the odd false start, or that ideally you might do in parallel with the existing system? Is it simply too hard and something as large and just in time as the health system?
A number of DHBs have been kind of clustering for their tech stuff. So it has been happening to some extent, but it's just a massive project. And the problem is that when you have a bunch of DHBs, they're kind of like separate entities on their own. They all want to do their own thing. A lot of them have got legacy-type systems that there's a lot of pain and a lot of cost to change. You know, doing the whole lot in one go, it's going to be really interesting to see the approach that they take. And I think, you know, this is something that most people would agree from a tech side needs to happen. Like, you can't, like, we're too small a country. You can't have, you know, even if it's 10, you can't have 10 different sets of tech systems around the country to run our health system. It's just not plausible. But the problem is getting from the current situation
to
where we're going.
Yeah. You know, you've still got the courts using paper. You've still got paper files following patients around. What gets in the way of doing what seems so blindingly obvious when it actually comes to the way systems work? And as we said, these are important. You can't have mistakes here. You can't have things going offline ahead of surgery. What are the practical challenges of such a big project?
You've got to remember that for each hospital and each DHB, we're not just talking about a single system as well. So we're talking about a whole bunch of different information systems and things that all have to talk to each other within the hospital to start with. And that's something that that often doesn't work particularly well as well. So it's getting better, but it's something that, Orion Health, one of our largest tech companies, you know, built their fortune on getting different devices and different systems within the hospital system to talk to each other. Across the US, the UK and a bunch of other countries as well. So it's a major problem in itself, let alone before you then scale that up to the different hospitals. And with tech, the biggest problem is always complexity. Like, tech handles complexity. That's why it exists. But it's always the thing that makes things so much more expensive, so much more complicated, is the complexity. And the more you put in it, the more different sort of pieces are in the
like
puzzle.
The tax department.
The more complex. Exactly,
which
like
has
the tax
just
department.
Done its massive computer project.
Yep.
Touchwood, basically, very successfully compared to others.
Yeah. Well, certainly some of the things that are coming out. I mean, there was some pain along the way, absolutely.
You can't keep tacking on. And there was a tripping point, I remember, with the IRD. There was one more set of, I think it was to do with the child tax credits or something. Yep. And that was just like, computer says no. So that's a real issue. So how would you break it down?
Yep.
Like, forget what is going to happen with the restructuring, but how would you break this down as a project, and where you've seen progress in those clusters of DHBs? Can that be like a role model? Can that be scaled up?
Yeah, and I'd imagine that's what they'll do. The first thing they'll do is do a big stock take. Part of the problem is that we've got an idea of what's being happening around the country, but we don't have a really clear understanding of what systems are in place right across the board. So there'll be a big stock take about who's using what and what components are there. They will likely pick the one that they think will be give the best outcomes at the end of the day. They may go for something completely fresh fresh, but it's very unlikely. This isn't just a sort of 6 month or a 12 month project. You know, this is something that will take some time, and we'll see. I'd imagine for a number of years that the systems that are in place now will continue to be used. You know,
lesson we've learned. You've got a parallel. Bang switch, but also, as you mentioned, these are multiple systems, and like some of them have extra complications. Patient privacy is a huge one,
massive,
right?
Yeah.
So, and then the ability to talk to for different parts of the system to talk to each other.
Mm. And there are a lot of parallels, you know, with the Inland Revenue Transformation Project. You know, we had a big legacy, or actually a set of big legacy systems within Inland Revenue that meant that they couldn't innovate, they couldn't do anything fast, there was no flexibility. You know, if they wanted to change a tax policy thing, it would take, you know, months to years to implement from the tech side. And now we've got a situation where, you know, we saw it with the business loans during COVID, where IRD can turn it around so quickly and within a matter of days implement something that would have taken months or potentially years later. And that's where the benefit will come once we get there. You know, it's a lot of pain to get there. And I think we've got to understand that, you know, it's not a quick process, it's not a cheap process. But when we get there, it's the ability to be flexible, the ability to innovate is where we'll win. So, you know, the reality is on the tech side, we're not going to save any money. Like, people have this perception that when you go big, you save money. Now, it just doesn't happen. It just literally doesn't happen. It increases complexity, and complexity is where cost comes in on a tech perspective. So we're not going to save any money, but what we will get, if it's done right, is we'll get a health system that's based on technology, that's innovative, flexible, and we'll be able to bring the kind of latest technologies into our system.
We're going to get more and more advanced with things like remote surgeries, and certainly remote consultations are going to increasingly become, you know, why have to travel from the West Coast to Canterbury to see a specialist if the tech is good enough to be doing
Absolutely.
It remotely, you know?
Yep.
But I don't know how much grunt there is in computer systems at the moment to enable that.
I think over COVID, we found that actually a lot of, not every circumstance, but in a lot of circumstances, you can do, visit your GP or your specialist remotely. Now, it's not perfect, and it's certainly not right for everything. You know, we obviously, we're not going to look at surgery or anything like that, or anything where you need physical.
But the potential is there, actually.
Well, it is there, yeah. And where it's worked, primarily overseas, is where you have the setup in different places, in our case, around the country, and you have one or two specialists, but they can operate remotely.
You know what? They'd probably be happy just to be able to get a file system that's functioning smoothly first, you know,
or a booking system
or a roster system or anything else. And talking of saving money, goodness me, in COVID, with the contact tracing challenges that there were, and the fact that everyone was on their own computer system, and the fact that part of that lockdown, frankly, was about getting things up to speed, well, how many, you know, what are we up to? $50 billion and counting in the government's overall COVID response. So this is where spending and time can over time, you know, lend the rewards.
Yeah, that's right. And it's, you know, again, and I know I'm repeating myself here, but it's going to be painful in the short term. Like, it's going to cost a lot of money to do it, but the payoff is down the road if it's done correctly.
The other thing is, will there be New Zealand firms in the mix here? Who was it who was up in arms last week about a contract that was given... a big contract that was given internationally? And if there is to be, as part of this process, a significant move and a streamlining of IT, is the capacity here to do projects on this scale?
Well, we've got some of the world's leading health tech companies in New Zealand. You know, this is the crazy thing. I mentioned Orion before, they're one, but there's others there as well. You know, on the equipment side, you've got Fisher & Paykel Healthcare and others. So, you know, we do have the expertise here. I mean, we've got to, you know, this is a big project. We've got to make sure that we do have the right people doing it. But we do, you know, we so often look overseas before we look to our own, and it's a real kind of almost cultural cringe thing that we have going on in New Zealand. Quite maybe not as bad as it used to be, but we should be looking to what our local industry can do, because they are capable and they're doing things like this for other countries already.
Okay, now the Productivity Commission tackles the frontier firms.
Yeah, that's right. So this is a final report that's come out from the government think tank, the Productivity Commission, and it's looked at this concept of frontier firms, so exporting firms who are generally scalable, generally productive sort of firms that are operating on that side of the market. And obviously this has a big implication on the tech side, but it's not just the tech industry, it's other industries as well. And I've got to say, like, it doesn't make very good reading. You know, when you look at the productivity or the labour productivity of our most productive companies, we're only sitting at about 45%. 20% of the most productive companies in other, what they call small advanced economies or SAEs, so essentially comparable countries. So we're less than half as productive as companies that are on the cutting edge and on that sort of frontier of exporting as other companies, as countries, sorry, that we would compare ourselves to. And that's pretty sad, I've got to say. And they've kind of dug into it quite a lot to try to figure out what's going on there. They think that it's really because we're spreading ourselves too thinly. So when we're investing, we're not kind of taking clusters or groups of companies in a particular area and growing them to scale. So we're not getting the scale that we can. That it's not just because we're a small country, because this is comparing ourselves to other countries of a similar size, that we're not getting them. And they kind of talk about this this concept of an innovative ecosystem. And I think we've talked about this before in the context of Xero.
We've been talking about this for decades. Tech clusters. But anyway, carry on.
Yeah, well, Xero's a really good example of an ecosystem that they've built up over a number of years in Wellington, and Trade Me and others are kind of part of it as well. But, you know, a big company that ended up, growing, scaling really fast by international standards as well. But it wasn't just about what Xero did. It's about what all of the companies around them were able to do kind of as part of that ecosystem. And what they're kind of talking about is taking that and putting it on steroids, picking some areas. And, I guess where it bothers me a little bit and where I start to say, oh, I'm not sure about this, is when they start talking about picking winners, because the government doesn't have a good track record of picking winners. And you've got to argue about whether it's the government's role to even pick winners, or whether they should be trying to create that environment where winners can fluster and go well.
So. They flourish.
Flourish, that's the word.
Flourish and prosper, I think, was our new word there. The thing is, we've just had a bunch of sales this year. Rocket Lab's off to list on the NASDAQ. I know it's like Xero. It's the one that everyone keeps naming. But actually, there's a whole bunch that have just been sold. Cracking business. I'm just trying to remember some of the names. Just in the last, there's about two or three, actually. Vend.
Yep, that's right.
I'm trying to recall some of the others as well. Going back further, you've got LanzaTech. And we grow to the size, and then owners say, I want out, or I want to restructure, and I want to list, yep. or I want to step back and become not a CE, but a something one out and one back. And how do you do anything about that? Like, how do you stop the fact that private entrepreneurs grow a business to a certain size and say, right, for my own reasons, I'm moving on.
Yeah, and you can't blame them for cashing out at that point. I mean, that's why they've developed that company. They've worked really, really hard to get to that point. But I guess the issue is what happens at that stage, and often it's sold overseas, often it's then grown to the next stage. And I guess the question is, how do we get that scale? How do we keep them in New Zealand and get that scale to continue here rather than offshore? I don't know whether this report really answers that, to be honest. I mean, it talks about trying to consolidate government spending on economic development into particular areas and those sorts of things. But I don't know if we've got the silver bullet here yet.
The reason is, why you want to stay here? We have a problem if they do get to the point of listing.
Mm.
New Zealand Stock Exchange is...
Yeah, it doesn't have the capital.
Treading water.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there other capital here that allows you to grow anything like a public listing? Probably not.
No, not to that scale.
And second, a lot of them are at a point where the logical joint ventures or the logical next development is actually with a long-established company somewhere else. So really the question's got to be, what can help us keep more of the firm, more of the revenue, more of the employees here, or what could make this a more attractive environment to be in?
Yep.
And I don't know that more government funding stuff is necessarily the answer to that,
No, and there are some areas where, New Zealand's doing particularly well. I mean, agritech's the one that we throw around quite a lot. You know, we've got a good history in agriculture. Some of the technology that's been developed in New Zealand around that is world-leading. But again, what can the government particularly do to foster that?
I'll tell you what's often overlooked, and we're going to do another interview on one of these people soon, actually, is some of what is coming out of those university startups companies.
Yep.
Really exciting stuff happening.
Yep.
And then again, the question is, okay, so how do we take it from that laboratory stage, beginning to launch as, commercial companies and grow and support those and keep them here?
Yep. And the report
we
did look at
we
that.
We could ask them, did the report ask.
Yeah, and what it basically found is that we're terrible at it. We're very, very bad at connecting the research institutions and the research that's being happened there with the commercialisation of it. I know this on the tech side because we've taken a bit of time looking at Australia and how they work around research funding and commercialisation and everything compared with New Zealand. And, you know, even Australia are streets ahead of us, let alone, by the time we go into a market like the US or something. You know, they see it as
doing
a core
what sort
part
of stuff?
Of the, well, just so for a start, the research funding itself in New Zealand on the tech
yes.
side is very, very
yes.
poor.
You're back reapplying for it every 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's right. And even when you are reapplying for it, you're lucky if you get it. The way that it's all structured in New Zealand is not good for tech. So you find on some funds, so for example, when you head to the Marsden sort of pure research blue skies type funding, a lot of the funds that get allocated in the space go to pure maths projects, for example. And technology isn't maths. You know, it came from maths on a computer science perspective, but it's just not the
Well, they're different things, and there should be different
right.
streams of funding, logically,
yeah.
shouldn't they?
Yeah, they should be. And the problem is that, without going into too much detail, but there's panels, and there's a panel that looks at maths, and they look at tech, and they say, well, this doesn't look like maths, so we're just going to fund the maths stuff. So the amount of funding that comes through...
I don't
through,
mind them finding the maths stuff, but can't we walk and chew gum?
Yeah, and when you compare it again, looking at Australia, we might say 10% of the revenue that comes through that panel, the funding that comes through that panel goes to tech-related projects. In Australia, it would be closer to 50%. So right at that core point, at the very start of that pathway, we're not seeing the investment into tech. So we're seeing government over a long period of time talking a good game about supporting tech and tech research and things. When push comes to shove, when the rubber hits the road, the research funding just isn't there. And that works right the way through to the MB funds that sort of sit in the middle, that are a little bit around the commercialisation, a little bit more about taking research that is applicable from a commercial perspective and supporting that. We're seeing the same sort of pattern there.
Okay.
The level of research funding is very poor.
Again, they're the same old questions. So basically what the Productivity Commission has done, perhaps, is put the finger on the same issues that people have been raising for ages, and the question is whether anyone will actually move to do anything.
Yeah, that's right. They've pulled it together, and I must say the Productivity Commission do a good job
yep.
of raising this stuff up
sure.
And sort of getting it on the radar of people who can make a difference. But it's a report. Two things will happen. More likely than not, it'll sit on a shelf and not much will come of it. People will refer to it and it'll be all well and good. What needs to happen is people need to look at that report and say, okay, well, it's identified where the problem is. I've identified some things that we can do to change it, and actually do it. And that's the piece that again, we'll cross fingers and we'll certainly do everything we can to support it. But I'm just not overly optimistic.
Okay. Now, Apple, what's coming out?
Yeah, that's right. So Apple, in typical Apple style, had their big mega event to release some new kit, but also outline their direction of travel, so where they're heading over the next little while. And, there was a few things that came from this. One that I'm quite interested in is the HomePod. So the HomePod is Apple's version of a smart speaker. Now, the original HomePod came out about 2018 and into a very crowded market. It was kind of where they were a little bit late to the party. There are a lot of speakers out there. They took a slightly different approach. So most of those smart speakers are kind of like a voice assistant with a speaker connected to it. They took more of a hi-fi approach. So they went for really high quality sound that happened to have Siri in it as well, and Apple Music and all the other bits and pieces that come with it. And it's kind of, it wasn't particularly successful. Very good gear. So those that had it absolutely sort of swore by it, but it just really didn't take off to the extent that they would like to. So they've canned that, and they canned that at the end of last year and brought out what they called the HomePod Mini, which is smaller, still good sound, not as good, but still pretty good sound, some of the best sound on the market. But the big news in terms of this update is they're finally coming to New Zealand. So, they've had these smart speaker things from early 2018 till now, and they're only finally bringing it to the New Zealand market. So it'll be interesting to see how successful it is over here. A lot of people import them anyway and bring them in from even Australia. Who have them. They work perfectly fine in New Zealand, so nobody really knows why they didn't release them here. But they are coming here, which will be good, and may kind of shake up that home automation market a little bit. Another thing that there was a lot of hype around was these things called AirTags, which is basically a Bluetooth tracker. Now, that's nothing new. So there's a company called Tile who has owned this market for a while. A few other generic brands in there as well. But essentially, it means that you can connect a little device onto something like your keys or your remote control. And if you lose it, you can track it with your phone. And what makes this announcement quite significant is it's kind of typical Apple. You know, they didn't come up with the idea, but their implementation is just right out there. So they're using some of the technology that's in the latest iPhones, you know, ultra wideband, they call it precision finding. What it essentially means is that they'll get a range of up to about 200 metres if you can't find your keys or your phone or not your phone because you need that to track it, your keys or whatever, and they can they can track that quite precisely. Now the other big thing about it, of course, is that if it's not within that range, they have they've connected it into what they call their Find My service, and what that means is that if anybody with an iPhone is near it anywhere in the world, it will track it and tell you where it is. Now privacy is a key part; they won't tell you who found it or anything like that, but it means that there are essentially about a billion devices worldwide that are tracking your keys or whatever if you've lost them. There are privacy concerns about that. I can see
that's the first thing
that came to mind. But it does mean that it kind of revolutionises that part of the market. And the Tile has been pretty successful, so it'll be interesting to see how it goes. A few other little quick things. They've talked about this for a while, but they've removed tracking from apps, so apps can't see what you do on your phone outside their app. Google and Facebook weren't happy about that. There was a lot of sort of to and fro about this, but they've just gone and done it. Apple's business model was about selling you good gear and supposedly looking after your privacy. Google and Facebook's business model is more about finding out more information about you to target their ads. So it fits a bit more in with Apple, but the others weren't so happy. The rainbow's back. In the late 90s, Apple was really revived on the back of the iMac G3, which came out in 13 different colours. You might remember the old big boxes. They've kind of gone more to black and silver in recent times, but they're now releasing their new iMac in blue and green and orange, pink, purple and silver. So the rainbow's back. It'll be interesting to see how that goes.
Excellent. Thank you very much. As always, Paul Matthews is Chief Executive of IT Professionals NZ.